Thank you. That's enough of that. Oh, that's enough. That's enough. That's enough. They just want. What you got to do is leave them wanting more. So I don't know about Mr. Whipple there. We would like to salute, before we go any further, we would like to salute a new development in the American commercial. See, I think that the American commercial tells a great deal about the spirit of the country and the joie de vivre that may or may not be evident in the country. Or, just general social, the geist, the zeitgeist, the world around, you know, the spirit, the atmosphere. Commercial really tells a lot. There's a new trend in commercials, especially automobile commercials, which I think bears commenting on, or at least recording for posterity. It's the first time I've ever seen commercials where cars will say proudly, and unequivocally, with absolute note of fervor in their voice, that they look like another car. Have you seen those commercials? and they even give you handy hints on how to tell the minute differences in their car from the other car. You see, of course, cars used to be very proud of the fact that they were distinct and unusual, but now cars are now beginning to sell themselves by, let's say, guilt by almost association. And I think this is should be recognized. And another thing that we should recognize in this age there will come a time when various other things will follow that lead. There will be a guy seen swilling a soft drink. So he said, "My God, I'd have sworn this was Dr. Pepper." And the voice will say, "Yes, you can't tell this from..." And great pride. In other words, imitation is not only the sincerest form of flattery, it's also the quickest way to get rich. So, how do you like that, huh? Dum, da, dum, dum. Now, for those of you in any other field, it would be called plagiarization. It would be called, to plagiarize. But plagiarizing has always been with us. Probably the first caveman that drew a picture on the wall, some guy was sneaking around in the back copying it and tossing it around to his friend. You know, look what I did, friend. it's a human tendency. There must have been a moment in a lemming's life when he was going over the cliff when a little voice says, "What the hell are you doing this for?" But he did it, didn't he, gang? He went right at it. But, guy has to do what he does. Well, it is spring, and of course springtime always means nutty time, and since we're all part and parcel of the same atmospheric conditions which operate on us, who was it who said, I don't want to bring him in, no, controversial author, I don't bring him in there, I won't even mention his quotation, I'll just think about it, quotation, I'll send it out to you. Controversial author made a quotation about spring. There. Oh, yes, speaking of nuttiness, I like to pick it up once in a while in TV Guide. For example, here's a little one-line description of a typical television offering of our day. Emergency! That's a great name for a show, anyway. Emergency! And here's the title or the preface, the little kind of capsule description of the show. Pressure 185, an embarrassed chef refuses to admit he set his kitchen on fire. Gee, that's exciting. There he is. Dobie Gillis discovers that somebody has put Spanish Fly in his Ovaltine. And the exciting things that happen after that make up tonight's. Well, have you noticed, though, that people don't want to be surprised? They really don't. And that's why they always publish in TV Guide who tonight's surprise mystery guest is going to be. Tonight's mystery guest of Orlando, Tony Orlando. By the way, have you ever figured out a way to tell Tony Orlando apart from Freddie Prinze? There is a rumor that they're the same guy. They are? Did you say that? That's amazing, yes. Very talented. He plays both those roles. That's very interesting. I know he's not Geraldo Rivera. I know that. No, there is a rumor that Geraldo Rivera is the father of both of those guys. So, you know, these rumors are ugly anyway. I don't like to bring ugly rumors in there. Hey, they've already started the bidding, you know, for big-time anchormen now. Yes, I saw a headline the other day, and of course, I remember all the Barbara Walters brouhaha, as Lee puts it, the Barbara Walters row. But you recall all that, you know, that all that business about the $1 million and so on a month, or was it a year, an hour, or a week, or whatever it is. It's got to happen. Really has to happen. I mean, Walter Cronkite's got to hold out. And then, of course, can John Chancellor be far behind? And then eventually, yes, eventually there will be a fourth network will break out, you know, like World Football. Offer Barbara Walters $100 million just to be there, you know. And it's got to happen. It's all in the wings, waiting. Oh yes, I say that 1980 will see things that we in 1976 will hardly be able to understand. I really believe that. But one of the other things that we must point out to you is that people today are looking for fantastic ways to escape. Fantastic meaning fantasy. Escape. To run away. Do you know that you can now buy a complete Daniel Boone outdoor leisure suit? Very nice. Yes, it's got fringe on it. And it's got a little place for your powder horn. And when you stand out there at the barbecue and you're roasting your bear meat, you can wear your little Daniel Boone leisure suit made of non-fading polyethylene fabric, two-way stretch, which Dan'l himself would have enjoyed, old Dan'l. But these are all part and parcel of the American way of life, and escape has always been an American dream. Well, that's why those guys went west in the first place. Most of them, although they pretended that they had to populate the West, and everybody gives, in his own way, a colorful, unbelievable usually, but nevertheless we all choose to believe it because rock one guy's boat and he's going to be rocking yours. That's an old human problem too. So everybody has to give an excuse for what he has to do that has nothing to do with the real reason he's doing it. You know, people will say, Madge, we have to have a divorce because it's for the good of the children. Anyway, he wants a divorce. no way. He could see himself, you know, swinging from the rafters in Las Vegas. So, we got to invent these little excuses. It makes life easier. And what it does is keep the gunfire down. Generally, I think gunfire is always just below the surface of almost every placid stream. Gunfire in one form or another. But I must say, before we get started, that escape is an American tradition. And in the bicentennial sense, the movement west, and why guys came from England in the first place to squat in the middle of the howling wilderness. Now, they pretend, a lot of them said, it's religious freedom. Well, maybe a few. But it was a desire to split, which very definitely plays a role at all times in man's history. This is also called the migratory drive. meaning you have a desire to get the hell out of wherever you are at this point and keep moving. It's a terrible drive. That's why Nader is having trouble getting people to give up their cars, because it's a basic urge, a basic urge to keep going. It started with the roller skate. It continued with the pogo stick. To run, to go, to move. There's an old folk comment that carries this out. The guy says, "Man, if God had determined that man should be in one place, he'd have been born with an anchor." Yep. I just invented that folk sense. So you can use it if you want, but don't say Shepherd said it. Nobody ever says, "Oh, come on, that guy." So what you have to say, it's an old Kentucky folk expression that gives it a certain patina of folk wisdom. Say, "Yeah, you want me to practice it again for you? If God had wanted man to remain where he was, he'd have been born with an anchor." Or conversely, you put it another way, if God had not wanted man to go, he wouldn't have given them feet. You can use that. But I kind of like the anchor thing better. We're not like the dandelion, which has a root that goes down 2.5 feet, as I learned now from TV commercials. Although I have known some people whose roots, unfortunately, extended to the center of the earth. You couldn't move them with a 12-gauge shotgun. since we're getting into the springtime here, we're clearing up a lot of the correspondence. We have a letter here from a teacher who writes from Queens. Says, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, you must get all kinds of letters in your work. Would you please tell me what happens to your ego and how do you feel when you get a letter that tells you that you're rotten and you're..." Well, that's a good question. I can only say this, and this is a serious comment. Anybody who's in show business, especially anyone who's a humorist or a comic, is used to the fact that from the very start of your career, there's always somebody who's writing a letter saying, "You're rotten, unfunny, dull, boring, and pompous." Incidentally, they usually do this in dull, boring, pompous terms, and because many people simply just don't vibrate the humor. Anything that's humorous is called non-adult. yes, of course, adults are never humorous. Not at all. They're pompous. And anyone who wants to be an adult... George Ade said it. He says, "If you wish to be accepted among the high and mighty, work on your pomposity." It's very important. So, nevertheless, this type of letter, you get this, and every time you get one of these letters... You usually get about 38 letters that say they dig you. So for every guy that thinks you're rotten and you should be blasted out of the firmament, there's 50 guys who dig it. And everybody, this is one of those things you just get used to. You don't even... In fact, right from the very beginning, I remember a guy who, a friend of mine, who later became a world-famous comic. He says that you're not doing it, Shepherd. He says, "You're really not getting to people if you don't get angry letters." And, that's very hard to believe, because most people in their work, it's quite the opposite. Most people in their work, if they ever get an angry letter about how rotten they do their work, they're flipping. But in the world of the comic, if he stops getting angry letters, then he knows he's having problems, because he's not saying anything anymore. So get them angry letters in here, folks. Let's get Shepherd fired by the weekend, right? Incidentally, speaking of the attempt to escape, you see it all over. Part of the escape syndrome is the Winnebago cult, and it's all the Winnebagos, all the various trailers and tent trailers, and all have very romantic names like Apache. somehow you're a migratory Indian. You got this 2 weeks off from the Dumont plant, and now you're on the road, say, and you're an Apache, and you're going forever and ever and ever with the wind blowing in your hair. Well, for anybody, I'll give you a brass fig leaf with bronze oak leaf palm. Who wrote a famous short story, speaking of escape? And one of the great escape things that people have always had in their head is the bird. The bird has always been a symbol in people's heads somehow for freedom. It always has. This is one of the reasons why we have the eagle. You know, the eagle is a bird that's rarely found in a cage with budgies, and he's a bird that is kind of a synonymous with freedom and flight and great heights. The eagle, escape. You notice that our national symbol is not the turtle. It is not an earthbound creature. And many, many countries have taken as the symbol a bird. The bird. What other country has a famous bird as a symbol? It's an English-speaking country. And what bird is it? All right, I'll give you a clue. It's in the totally different hemisphere. The other half, 12,000 miles away. And they're always singing the Waltzing Matilda. Okay, Australia. Australia. What is their bird? They have a symbol. And the bird is a very common symbol. So very early in man's walking around. Yeah, I know there's a lot of commercials. Okay. Walking around in man's daily life, it must have been very early in the caveman's life when he looked up at the sky and saw those birds and briefly had a feeling that he would like to be able to do that. You know, what the bird does, which is, you know, just sails with so effortlessly over all the country where, everybody else has to struggle up down one side of a hill and up down the other side of the hill and swim over the creek and struggle through the woods, but the bird just sails over it all, right? Just sails along. And due to the fact that the bird is an aerodynamic creature, he has an innate beauty to him. He has to be streamlined. There are no square birds. Not at all. So he's got that. Even the little short fat birds like owls, still, when they fly, they have a zeppelin shape, but you notice they're beautifully tapered, nicely aerodynamically designed. So this is an exciting thing to you. From the very earliest time of your life, you see birds. Well, man has always, been the idea of flying. Now, flying frightens many people, but on the other hand, they're fascinated by it. I think there are two kinds of people, really, basically, going all the way back to our earliest childhood, maybe even beyond. There's the nesters and the movers. And the nesters are people who instinctively want to dig a hole in the ground and creep down into it and pull it over them and hide. Those are nesters. You see them in the offices often. A guy who's afraid in his office, who's a nester in his office, will tack things up all over the wall. He'll pile stuff up on the desk, and so he's surrounded like a great drift of stuff that protects him. And the more stuff he piles up on the walls and the floor and every place, the more secure he feels in there. It's a nest he builds. And it's the jackdaw nest. You bring stuff in and hide things and all around the desk and pile it up. It takes a lot of courage to have this nice, clean, smooth, uncluttered desk, which is not a nest at all. It's just a desk. And so you see nests, and old ladies, for example, tend to collect doilies and furniture. And you see just one old lady will live in a place and she'll have 45 chairs around there in the living room, and she'll have a dining room table with eight places around it, and it's a nest. It's a lot of curtains and drapes that shut out the world, and Venetian blinds and all kinds of things that stop the light from coming in. It's a nest. Well, these people are almost instinctively against flying, because flying is the very reverse of nesting. You've even divorced yourself from the earth. And one of the most exciting things to most kids are particularly prone to this flight they want to get going, is the kite syndrome. You know, one of the great sights in my life, a very funny little sight, which you never would expect. I was in a town a few years back in central Nigeria. And this is a town you had to travel in from Lagos, which is near the coast. It's on the coast, in fact. You had to travel directly inland away from Lagos, like a couple of hundred miles, and it was through all kinds of bush and brush and pretty wild country. And one little tiny road that went in there. And finally we got into this town, and as we approached the town is lying in a kind of a valley with hills that rose up around it. And it was a great vast town that was built flat. It looked like thousands of little silvery sheets as you came from a distance, because it was all made of galvanized iron and stuff, tin, and the sun was flashing off the roofs. But as you came closer to it, you saw up in the air there were hundreds of kites just drifting over the town, red and green and yellow, all the same kind, triangular type, the classical triangular-shaped kite. And the kids obviously were all flying kites. They flew kites there. It was really a great sight to see these kites floating in this Nigerian air as you came down this trail, down a long hill into this town. And it was kind of a beautiful scene. And you see kites. Always in the spring, people fly kites. They don't often fly kites in the winter. And yet, there is a nice breeze in the winter. The wind blows. In fact, there's often a steadier breeze in the winter than there is in the summer. And yet, you don't find many kite flyers in the winter. But it's quite rare. But spring is the kite time. And it is a deep-seated urge. I don't know of many girl kite flyers. There are probably many of them. I don't know about them. I just never really saw many. In fact, have you seen this new book? Will Yolen, for example, wrote a book called, it's a great book if you're into kites, called Kites and Kite Flying. And it's like a historical book and tells you how to make all these great kites. And it's a kite book. It's about real kites, not the little gimmicky Madison Avenue kites, but real kites of all kinds. And one of the big things that hit me when I was a kid, as a gift, I was given. First of all, most of us made our own kites, and everybody flew kites when I was a kid, but we made them. And it's very easy to make a kite. A kite is a simple thing to make, but it's not a simple thing to make well. Most people just, they put a couple of sticks together. And the first kites I ever made were kites I got out of the model shop, and I got myself a couple of big pieces of balsa wood, usually a quarter inch thick by something like 3/8, something like the flat strips, nice big long piece of good hard balsa wood. And very light, and I'd look over all the balsa that the guy had. He had it usually sitting up in a kind of a rack where you could pick the different sizes, and you pick these two good pieces of balsa that don't have any weak spots in them, and you test them, and then you finally buy them. Building the kite then is quite simple if you know how to do it, and I would cover it with airplane paper, the kind of paper that you use to cover airplane models. I'd buy myself a couple of sheets of good Japanese rice paper, which is what this kind of airplane paper is. And then after you finish the kite, you spray the kite, in case you're interested. You should. Now, I'm telling you as an expert kite maker here. In other words, you don't have to spray it, but if you do spray your kite, it makes it tougher and does not add a great deal to the weight. What you do is take a light spray of clear airplane dope, the kind that they spray on a model, and just spray it very lightly so that it gives it a little toughness. And then select your string. Of course, today you can get some really great monofilament lines to fly a kite with, but get yourself a very light silk string. Often we used to use bait casting line, which has a pretty good tensile strength, And then you'd get this kite. This kite would rise up. Well, after we started experimenting with kites of, the traditional diamond-shaped kite, kind of a lopsided diamond, which is just a cruciform, a cross form. You move into the more sophisticated kites, which really fly. Let me tell you, a box kite is a beautiful flyer. And and they'll fly in a very light breeze. And you can get a good box kite up. Well, a great kind of a sub-fad began to develop. And, you know, most people think in terms of building the very spectacular kites, like a fish, Chinese, Japanese kites with the fish and the dragons and all this kind of stuff. They're okay. But that's another tradition. The Batman kite is not a real kite. It's a gimmick. But then when you start getting into kites, you start experimenting with really exotic kites. And so there was this kid named Johnny Falk, a fantastic kite builder in the neighborhood. And he built a really beautiful biplane kite. Now, this is a kite that had two planes, two wings on it, really like biplane wings. And one wing was yellow, one was blue. I remember he had these two wings, and he had a small framework that came down, like an open fuselage. And he had what would be, in effect, a rudder. And then he had a stabilizer that came out the front. It looked like a biplane, a little bit like the Wright-type airplane. Wow, what a flyer. That thing, you know, he'd sit up there. And I'll bet none of you could actually tell me what the world's record right now, the highest altitude ever achieved by a kite without artificial gimmicks, you know, like attaching it to an airplane or something. What was the highest ever achieved by a kite? You would be astounded how high a kite can get. You know, I knew a guy, speaking of kites and escape, I knew a guy who I came over to see him one time. This is a couple of years back. And he had an office on Madison Avenue. He was in one of these little cubicles that was in a big agency. And it was one of the rare agencies, which incidentally is on Madison Avenue. For those of you who don't live in New York, most of the agencies are not on Madison Avenue. They're just simply not. There's all kinds of them on Lexington, and many of them on Park. Some of them are 3rd Avenue. But this guy was really in a true Madison Avenue agency. So he's way up on the 38th floor, 46th floor or something in this big glass building. And he had this window, and these windows, you could open them up a little bit, see, just a little bit, like you could swing them out, maybe about a foot and a half, and they were cleverly cut so that the ad exec could not jump out, you see. They're always afraid some guy's going to say, oh, I've had it, you know, out he goes. See, it's very bad public image to suddenly find three account execs flying through the air simultaneously. In formation, you know, holding hands, the guys that work on the beer commercial, see, as they volplane down, but with no chutes. streaming match covers that have the agency slogan on it. But nevertheless, this guy, one day I came over to see him, and we were going to go out to lunch. And I came up the elevator, and I go through the hushed floors, past all the hushed receptionists. They even had color-coded receptionists. You know, every department had a girl in a different chic Bianchi costume, you know, elegancy. They had pink telephones. I finally get to this guy's office, and the girl says, go right in. He's waiting for you. So I go in, and I don't see him. And I look around, and I see his desk. See, his desk is right there in front of the window, and I walk over to the desk, and I hear a sort of a scuffling and a grunting, and there he is. He's down behind the desk. And then I see coming out from behind the desk is a string going out the window. And this guy is flying a kite. I said, but Stan, what are you doing? Shh, don't say anything. Every lunch hour, for about 15, 20 minutes, I find my box kite out of the window when the wind is in the right direction. And he assembles it, and he sticks it out the window. The updraft takes it out, and there was his kite flying out there, beautiful, clear, and proud. And it was hanging out there over over Lexington Avenue, and you could just see it up there amid the pigeons, you know, and the Jersey crud that was drifting down. I said, Stan, my God, you're an incurable romantic. He says, yeah, but I got to cover my tracks. I said, what do you mean cover your tracks? He says, well, take a good look at it. I said, take a good look at what? He says, the kite. Look carefully. Take these binoculars. Look at it. So I take the glasses and I look up at it. There, right on it, was the slogan of the Rice Krispies Company. You know, snap, crackle, pop, cereal. See, he was on the Rice Krispies account. So in case somebody came in and yelled at him, he, you know, you don't fly kites around here on our time. He always said, well, I'm trying out a new gimmick, you know. We're going to send out kites to the kids. You see the whole thing. Man has to keep covering his tracks. Like I say, you invent an excuse for everything you do, but it's never the real reason. And so we're getting a divorce for the kids' sake.
You've been listening to Gene Shepherd, humorist, author, and recipient of the Mark Twain Award for 1976.